we covered a lot of ground in the last two lectures about gaseous detectors, mainly for ionization, detecting ionization and things like that. So we're going to finish that up today. And we're going to finish up tracking in general. So we'll be done with week six or unit six of the material. So there's going to be a few different technologies, a few different ways of doing detectors that I'll talk about. And today, I did it a little bit last time, but today especially, and a lot of the next weeks, I'll be showing you examples from various detectors to help hopefully explain or just show a demonstration of what things look like or how they're built, you know, and whatever. And, you know, ask questions. There's no crazy question. I think, you know, there's a lot of details of the detectors and stuff or how they work or why they were chosen. We'll get into combined systems in a couple units after we get through calorimetry and particle ID. Combined systems meaning, okay, now I know how to build a silicon detector and a calorimeter. How do I put this all together to make a complete thing? Or, you know, I know how to do calorimetry and I can do tracking in a calorimeter. How do I put that together to make a neutrino detector? So we'll get to that later. So we're just talking about individual pieces. Okay, so one of the kinds of ionization detector that's used is called a straw tube. And, okay, you can say, well, you know, we've already talked about quite a few ionization detectors. Why do we have to keep coming up with new ones? Well, there's always a reason. We saw, for instance, when we had multi-wire proportional chambers, that they have a couple drawbacks, at least the original versions. One is you've got a bunch of wires in an open volume, and if one of the wires breaks, you've got things at a high voltage, that wire is going to flop around and it's going to have problems for other wires. So it's not modular. Another problem is, you know, the wire distances are not that great. So are fairly large. So you can imagine building drift tubes, which we've seen. But those tend to be pretty big. And they have another drawback, which is that the examples that we did, we had these heavy metallic frameworks that we needed to support the drift tubes. So we had these metal, you know, sort of box, long, you know, a box of a tube. Well, you know, there's a lot of radiation lengths in all that material. Not necessarily the best kind of a detector to put in the way of particles if you don't want to have a lot of energy loss. Okay? So people tried to, and you'd also like to be able to build things smaller than you can in those technologies. So people came up with straw tube. A straw tube is almost literally what you think it is. It's something about as wide as a straw. So a wide straw tube is about a centimeter. So, you know, okay, that's probably a McDonald's straw. But, you know, other straws are narrower. And, you know, so it could be a half of a centimeter. But those are pretty small compared to the drift tubes that we've talked about before. So they're pretty narrow. And, of course, down the middle you have the same 20 or 50 micron wide sense wire or signal wire in the middle. So it's just a long cylindrical tube. But what it's made of, this is not made out of metal. I mean, there's metal in it, but it's a plastic called mylar. Plastics are nice. We talked about this when we talked about scintillators. They're not very heavy. You don't necessarily lose a lot of energy in the wall of this tube. And but then it would be aluminized, and you can basically have an electrode on the wall of that tube. So you've got a very lightweight. You know, straws are fairly rigid, but it's a fairly lightweight thing, and you can run a wire through it. And then, for all intents and purposes, it behaves very much like a drift tube at that point. It's what it is. It's just not as big and heavy. It's not as old-fashioned as the one that we've talked about so far. So they can be very narrow, and actually spatial resolutions, you know, that we've talked about so far have been anywhere from about 100 microns to several hundred microns with gaseous detectors. But in the straw tube case, they've gotten actually spatial resolutions of 30 microns, so it's pretty impressive. Okay? There are some advantages of straw tubes, and I'll go into an example in a minute, but one of the things is that they're small. They don't have a very wide diameter. So when a particle passes through here, those ionization electrons don't have far to go to get to the wire and to get read out. Okay? So there's a short drift distance. It means the drift time is faster. The whole response of the system is faster. So if you're in an experiment where you have lots of events coming in at a time, or in quick succession, then you would have a problem with most gaseous detectors because they just take too long. Drift velocities and drift times are just too long, and all your events will just pile up and you'll have a gigantic mess. But the worst case would be the LHC. So you really need to reduce those times, and so a straw tube, it's still a gaseous detector. You're still not going to do great, but it's much better than the normal kinds of drift technologies that we talked about. The other thing is that if you recall when, it's not a great drawing on the slide, but if you recall when we talked about a drift tube, that when an ionization electron starts to propagate to the wire, if there's a magnetic field and that field is directed along the wire, what happens is there becomes a transverse force on that ionization electron, which causes the path not to go straight to the wire, but to kind of spiral in to the wire. Okay, we talked about this before. There's a nice drawing in Gruppen and Schwartz, one example for a rectangular drift tube configuration. Since the straw tubes are smaller, this doesn't happen as much. Okay, they don't have that far to go, so they don't get build up as much of a velocity in this direction, and they don't get around. So the effect on the drift time is reduced of a magnetic field, and the drift time, of course, is the basis of the spatial resolution. So it has a reduced effect on the spatial resolution of this kind of a detector. So straw tubes are probably, they're sort of the best you could do with a drift tube in some sense. It's the smallest drift tubes that we know how to make. The other thing that's nice about them, which is very similar to the arguments that we talked about when we talked about drift tubes, is they're modular. So if I break one, I can go and make another one. I don't have to replace the whole device. And the other one is that the wires are isolated, as I said before. If that wire breaks, and that does happen, and it's very scary if you have a drift chamber and a wire breaks, it just affects that. You just turn that channel off and it's dead. Okay, but it's not a disaster for your whole detector. Okay? So, these are straw tubes. And so an example of straw tubes is the Atlas TRT, the Transition Radiation Tracker. The TRT has two elements. One is the part involved with the transition radiation production. Well, I'm not going to talk about that yet. We'll do that when we talk about particle ID. But once that's done, there's an ionization sensor, which is straw tube technology. So let's have a couple pics of that. Okay, so this is actually just a general simple drawing of a potential straw tube configuration you might have in a collider detector. So you have a beams coming in on that little plus sign in the middle. There's a collision, and then the particles go outward from that. And so, you know, one thing that you could see is that if you just had one row of tubes, you would have a little bit of a problem, because some fraction of the time, and this will come up when we talk about scintillating fibers, some fraction of the time the particle will go right in the crack between the fibers and you'll miss it. So in this configuration, a set of tubes with a smaller radius was placed in those gaps to cover that region, so that you will always see, you'll either see ionization in this row or in the row before. Okay? For ATLAS, this is a picture of the TRT in assembly, and there are many, many rows. Each one of these green pads here, you see a little white dash on them, those are actually readout electronics boards that are attached to each of the drift tubes. Okay, so there's a drift tube. So there's in each of these triangular wedges, there are many, many, many drift tubes. Okay, and the way that this is built is, you can imagine if you had 20, just take straws, 20 straws, okay, and you tape them all up, it would be fairly rigid over some length. But if you tried to tape 5,000 of them, it starts to become very heavy, and you need a support structure. So all of this cross-ribbing and everything is to group them and keep them all still and stiff while not having too much material. So this is just a picture of that detector. Obviously, it's not... Well, it's running now, but in this... Now, this is in the region, in the central region, meaning in the... When we have a beam, we have a collision, and so now we have a cylindrical detector like this. Okay. And so particles can come out into this region. So when we say central, we're meaning angles that are very transverse, very closer to perpendicular to the beam. So, you know, anywhere in this wedge you would call central, okay, as opposed to forward. So if you recall, we talked about this use of terminology before. Central is also low eta, low pseudorapidity. Okay? So this is the barrel region, the central region. It's the region where particles are coming fairly transverse to the incoming beams, and you see a cylindrical arrangement. However, if you go in the forward direction, so now we're going out here, I have to make this barrel really, really long to get to further and further angles, and there becomes all kinds of problems with doing that. A much better thing to do would be to just put a plate here, a disc, okay? And that's what this is. I mean, this is just a piece of it, but this is now, you don't have straws that are going along the beam direction. You have straws that are coming radially out in this way. Okay? So that's what you have here. And then you've got the electronics at the end of the straws. So this is the end region, the forward region of the TRT. So there's disks. And you'll see, as we talk about other tracking detectors, each of them tend to have this division in a collider detector. Any collider detector you could pick will have that situation. Okay? Okay. now, okay. Now, all the ionization detectors I've talked about have been very similar to each other in a lot of respects. But people are increasingly trying different things with them. One of the ways that people have been building ionization detectors is a so-called gas electron multiplier. And we had a speaker. I had invited Professor J.U. from UT Arlington last December, and he talked about work that they're doing on such detectors. And they have all kinds of applications in particle physics and astrophysics and in medical physics. And in fact, we have work here in our own department going on, and GEMS is the acronym for them, for the E-Bubble project. So let me just describe the idea behind a GEM. Hopefully a lot of these elements will sound kind of like a broken record. There are a lot of similarities, but then there are important differences. So again, you start out with a volume, a gas-filled volume, and it will have two electrode planes above and below. And now instead of putting wires in here, like we did in a wire chamber, what you do is you put up a plane, a layer or a foil in the volume that's parallel to the electrode planes. And this layer starts out just being a plastic layer. Could be a material called Kapton. There's other materials. But it's non-insulating. And then what you do is you put a thin film on it of some conducting metal. Could be copper. Okay? So you just take a thin film, a thin foil sheet, and then you coat it with copper on the top and on the bottom. Okay? So this is copper as well. All right? Now, what you want to do is, what is done is when you have these ionization detectors, as we talked before, one of the important elements is to get a good multiplication of the initial ionization charge. Right. You try to set up a condition where that initial ionization shown by the electron can cause an avalanche, and you get a big multiplication. And then that multiplication allows you to read it out okay relative to the electronics noise you'll have later. All right, and a lot of times in other cases we talked, we had multiplications of 10,000 or 1,000 or 10,000 or things like that. But we needed these large detectors and whatever to do it. Well, here, what's done is you take this layer and you actually chemically treat it in specific regions so that you essentially burn away or dissolve away holes in the material, okay? Now, they don't look like this. They actually have this sort of wedge shape thing. So they get narrower in the very center, and this, you know, some of this is done just to help in getting a better multiplication. But you've got, it's hard to represent it, but you've got a circular hole in this layer of material, all right? So now what happens is you put a voltage on the top layer and on the bottom layer, so there's a significant voltage difference here, and I have a particle comes through this device, and it produces an ionization electron. Now, there's a voltage difference over this whole chamber. So an electron, when it gets produced, wants to go down in this drawing, okay? Regardless of this gem, this Kapton layer or whatever, the electron is going to want to go down, okay? So it's going to go down, and it's going to come into this gap, this little hole. And in this hole, because of the voltage across it, there's going to be a big multiplication. An avalanche is going to happen there. So you're going to get a lot of charge produced, and it's going to pass through that gap, And then it's going to get into this bottom area and drift down to the plane on the bottom, okay, the electrode on the bottom. And then you read it out, and these are just wires. So you have a segmentation. You can measure the position in this direction, the direction. You can measure the position in this direction, okay? So that's how a gem works. And you read it out electronically. The sizes are usually that the spacing between holes is about 1 to 200 microns, and the holes are about half that, 50 to 100 microns. And anyways, you can. That's what you have. Now, this is okay. This is well, I've already said this. So you get the multiplication in this gap. There's a nice drawing. I'll show it of the electric field. Okay. So why don't I just do that? Gotta help myself. All right. So this is a drawing, a little easier to read, of what the electric and electric field and the potential look like. So what you've got here, the equipotentials are shown here, this wavy line here, okay? And then the electric field lines are these things. So what you can see is there's a gradual potential drop as we go all the way down here. Obviously, the potential drop is biggest in this hole, in this gap region. But in any case, any electron will want to first come here, and then it will come back out, and it will continue in this direction. And then you see there's a very a lot of electric field and a very strong potential difference through here, and that's why you get the multiplication that I said, and then you continue down to the anode plane. These are actually some plots for the eBubble project. So this is actually showing you the actual gem, that actual layer that I was mentioning. And you just have these circular holes. The separation here is about 100, I guess it varies, but 1 to 200 microns. And this is the layer that goes in the device, as I said. Okay? What this actually is, this is a result that they came up, which is that if you change the temperature, what you have here is that the voltage across this thing gives you a certain multiplication factor. It's very important to get a big multiplication factor. So this is a log scale, but you have a factor of 1, 10, 100, 1,000. And what you can see is that multiplication factor is a strong function of the voltage difference, okay, which makes sense. And it's also a function of the temperature. Okay, so that's a gas electron multiplier. Okay, so that's all I have to say about ion. Well, I guess this is an ionization detector too, but different kind of thing. So a gaseous detector. That's all I have to say about gaseous detectors. The two other types of tracking. Drift chambers, all the things that we talked about, have been very important to particle physics over the last many decades. And they're useful in various contexts. In high event rate situations, they're not ideal for the reasons I talked about. So in the regions near the interaction, they're usually not used. The exception that you have here is the TRT straw tubes, but they had to make them small and things, but it's used there. Of course, in the muon systems of these detectors, which is very far away and much lower number of events, it's fine. So as we talked about, both Atlas and D0 use drift tubes for their muon systems. But what has taken over in the region close to where the interaction happens is really mostly semiconductor detectors. Okay, and this is a development, it's just been an accelerating development over the last 20 years. So I want to spend some time on this. It's very important. It's not just important for collider detectors or even for particle physics. It's used in other cases. It's used in high-energy astrophysics satellites and other things. So, okay. Well, we talked about before, let's just briefly, when we have a semiconductor, we have this situation, we went back to band theory, and we talked about that briefly, and we said, well, what you've got in insulators is that the valence electrons are, did I say insulators? I said insulators, right? I don't want to confuse you guys. Okay, so in insulators, the valence electrons, the electrons that are in the atom, those things, their energy levels are in a band in a solid material. We talked about how the energy levels get kind of smeared out into a band in a solid because you have the electric fields of all the adjacent atoms and things. But that energy band called the valence band is far away from the energy band that corresponds to electrons that can conduct, that are not tightly bound to the atoms. Okay? So it's very hard to take an electron on those atoms and to move it. That's why they're insulators. Okay. We also said that conductors, it's the opposite. The energy difference between an electron being in the valence band and the conduction band is negligible or zero. So it's very easy. The electron just pops out and all of a sudden it's moving around. And then in semiconductors, you have the in-between case. And there are many, many orders of magnitude here difference. But in the semiconductor case, you have the situation where the energy, the gap in energy level between these two bands is of moderate size. Moderate could mean it's similar to the size that would be optical photon energy. Okay, that could be one way to decide it's moderate. Okay, but it's in this in-between state. So silicon is the class example of a semiconductor. So what you have is a material where if I have some energy loss in the material, it's a solid now, but you can start to think about this not just dissimilarly to the gases in some sense, but if I have a solid material and a particle passes through that, there's going to be some loss of energy, some dEdx, some ionization loss, in the same way that we talked about before. The particle will interact with those atoms, and it will lose energy, and so there will be ionization that's produced in that material. And once those electrons are produced, they're in the conduction band. They can move around in the material. Okay? So they can just go. All right? So, and they're not drifting either. They're in a conduction band. That's a different mechanism. Now, what you can do is you can have a detector. Well, I could just draw a simple example. I can have a piece of silicon here, and if I put a voltage difference across electrodes on either side of this thing. Those electrons that just got produced, I have a way to get them to go to one of the electrodes and read them out. Okay? So, I have a way to get these electrons out of the device, and I have a way to get them out. The nice thing, well, there's a couple of nice things. First of all, I'm not dealing with wires. I have a solid piece of structure here. It's also solid, redundant, but meaning it's higher density. So per distance, I'm going to get more ionization. So to get the same amount of ionization, I'm more compact in size. It's rigid, which we don't have those problems with wire sagging and things like that. And you can take these two electrodes and you can divide them up into pieces. So if a particle passes here, and I had divided this up this way, and I see a signal on those two pieces of my electrode, then I know that the particle was somewhere over here. I know it wasn't over here. Okay? So I can segment these electrodes to get a spatial measurement, which is the whole point of doing tracking, is to get that spatial measurement. The other thing about it, so I'm mostly referring here to ionization, but that's not the only situation that these detectors are relevant. So in the ionization case, just as an example, one of the examples given in Gruppen and Schwartz was that in a pure silicon device, about 90 ion pairs are produced per 1 micron of distance traveled in the device. So 1 micron is incredibly tiny. It's 1/100th of the thickness of your hair. So it's an incredibly tiny distance, and you get 100 ions. So if you travel, and that's actually similar to the kinds of electronics noise that you might see, that you might have to deal with. So if you do many times that distance, which is still not a very thick distance, you can get a large signal. So that's one thing. So ionization is one way. That fact that you get more ionization than a gas detector is important, and this is often not stated very clearly. It is one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why silicon detectors give much better spatial resolution than ionization detectors. Okay. There's just a big almost an order of magnitude difference between the two ways of doing it. The other way that you can take, that you can get ions, is to have photons be incident on the semiconductor. And as I said, a semiconductor has an energy gap similar to optical photon wavelengths. And so if I have optical light incident, or something close to optical light incident on that thing, I may be able to get some electrons out. Okay, I won't spend a lot of time on that, but I'll mention it a little bit. That is, of course, what is in your digital camera, if you have one on your cell phone or something. Okay, so I'm going to talk about three different renditions of semiconductor detectors. You'll see a lot of commonality in these, but hopefully you'll see how they're a little bit different and what their competing aspects are. So the first one is a silicon microstrip detector. Actually, before I go into that, I have a diagram here. This is a fairly generic diagram, much better than the thing I drew. So this is from Gruppen and Schwartz, I think. So here, again, you have your silicon material. you have electrodes up here that are segmented in this direction, and then down here you just have an electrode. It could just be a pad. It doesn't have to be segmented at all. This would give you sensitivity in this direction in terms of position measurement. Okay? And these are very small strips of conductor, so they're called microstrips oftentimes. So that's allows me to jump into this. So silicon microstrips. So here what you have, this is a poor man's version of the same thing. You have strips. You've now taken this electrode. I've exaggerated the distance between them, but you've taken that electrode and you've separated portions of it off into long strips in one direction, and then you will get ionization in that direction. Remember, you'll get in one case you'll get the electrons, and in the other case you'll get some image from the positive ions that were produced. So the separation here would generally be about 20 microns, which gives you a spatial resolution of about 10 microns. This is way better than any other kind of detector. I mean, it's just way better. It's a very impressive position measurement and very important. The basic idea is not different than what we talked about with the multi-wire proportional chamber. Okay? If you recall, we had, instead of silicon, we had a gaseous volume, but then the charge went to wires and then we read them out. And if we wanted to be sensitive to both directions, we put another layer of wires, say in a perpendicular direction. So we could take this bottom electrode and we could segment it in the orthogonal direction. And now, depending on where a particle passed, we could determine what its coordinates are in both directions. Okay? So it's that trick gets used over and over and over again. It's not a technology-specific trick of using different layers, anodes and cathodes in different orientations, whatever you will, to get that sensitivity. Examples of silicon microstrip detectors are the D0 silicon microstrip tracker and the Atlas semiconductor tracker. So let's take a look at what these guys look like. So one of the things I want to point out, so what you have here are, hopefully you can see, you have a cylinder of planes. So there's a set of boards that are the silicon, and there's in this central region, much like I talked about before for the straw tubes with the Atlas TRT, but then in the forward region, you have these disks, because to get out here, you'd have to extend an enormous number of channels out here, and you'd actually not do a very good job. Everything would be very stretched out. And to make sure that everything was covered, there's more disks in here. If you look at the Atlas, this is it's very similar. I mean, they're different experiments, but they're going to be very similar. Again, here, the actual planes of the semiconductor are cocked a little bit. They're not quite orthogonal to the outgoing particles. You see they kind of go like this. They sort of go like this instead of like this. Okay? So that's the Atlas case. That's the D0 case. This has the advantage that a particle always goes through some detector. If you do it this way, then you have to put something here. Okay? So and this is in the end region. Okay? Okay, I haven't gotten there yet. Okay. All right. Now, there's another way to do this. Instead of these electrodes being sort of these wires are microstrips on the surface, what you can do is you can build your semiconductor in such a way that regions, this is a plane, a sheet of semiconductor. Okay, I can build it in such a way. Well, I can't build it in this way, but okay, somebody can do it. Where I can segment in one direction or two directions regions of that plane from each other, so that this region is sensitive to, I could produce ions here, but then there is a electric field that prevents these electrons from migrating into this region. Okay? So there is a potential well. I have a particle that may come and produce some ionization in this place, and then those electrons are trapped. They can't move. All right? So it goes back to undergraduate modern physics. It's literally a potential well. Okay? So those electrons cannot move from that location. All right? Now, of course, we need to read it out. Otherwise, we can't do anything with this detector. So what happens is, this is a very crude rendition of it, but it's a first pass. I label the three potential wells. Let's say I just have a device, really simple device, where I just have three pixels, okay, and I need to read out these things. What happens is, in this sort of device, a pixel device, you have the ability to reduce the field here so whatever charge was here can be read out. Okay? It's not a fixed thing. You can change this electric field, all right? So now I can read the charge out. Now it's empty. I can then lower this field and let this charge move into this bucket. And then I can read it out. And then once that's gone, I can do that with this one. Okay? Now, it's very sequential, which takes a lot of time. But I really know I can make these pixels very small. I can make them 10 microns, very tiny. So then I can get an even much better resolution. But I have to read them out sequentially. So this is kind of just a step-by-step. You read out the first one, then you move 2 into 1, and then you read it out, and then you move 3 into 2 into 1, and then you read it out, etc. Okay? Now you can do this in one dimension, or you can do this in two dimensions. But you get the idea. So you read out the detector pixel by pixel. All right? Now, this... There's a couple different, So that way of doing it, that kind of pixel detector is probably the true pixel detector, okay, in the sense of how people originally meant the word. It's referred to by the term charge-coupled device, partly because of the way that I just described this readout pattern. So CCD, you've heard the term CCD, okay? In particle physics, this is used in both particle physics and astrophysics. And so in particle physics, as I mentioned before, you're creating electrons due to ionization, okay? Even though the silicon gives you a good amount of ionization, you don't get a tremendous number. You're dealing with a thin piece of silicon, and the readout is slow. So this kind of detector has been used for particle physics, but it wouldn't be, this version of it wouldn't be appropriate for a very high rate situation. Now in astrophysics, or high energy astrophysics, and there's no clear boundary between these two fields. There's a spectrum. You're generally dealing with the photoelectric effect, and here you're sensitive to photons that are incident. Okay? So now you don't have a particle passing through the pixel and ionizing. You have a photon striking the pixel and causing ionization. And the number of electrons is directly related to the number of photons produced. It's a photoelectric effect. So that makes the device very linear. And, this is a general statement. So an example of this is the ROTC telescope. So I mentioned that because we have people working on that in the department. There's one thing I want to mention about this, because it will be relevant for talking about the next device, is that these potential wells have a finite height. It isn't actually true that the electrons can't get from one to the next one. They can, and they're electrically connected to each other. It's just a high potential wall. So if you get too much ionization, what will happen is the electrons will spill from this pixel into neighboring pixels in the readout direction. Okay? And I don't know if you've seen this sort of thing or not. So, an example. So, for instance, here, this is just an image. If you could see this sort of long shape, that's not what the star actually looks like. Okay? This is actually charge from an object that's too bright, producing too much ionization, and it's bleeding out into the neighboring channels. Okay? Now, this kind of thing happens in a CCD. It happens in other detectors as well. So that means that the measurements in this region are a bit messed up. So you don't want that to happen. Okay? Okay. I'm still not there. I can't put these things all in one file because of copyright. So I can post my lecture notes, but I can't post the figures from the texts. So I have to keep them separate. So I'm sorry I have to keep going back and forth. Sort of frustrating. I will hand them out to you, though. I should have done that before. Okay, so that's a charge-coupled device. That's a pixel detector. Now, there is something called a hybrid pixel detector. And a hybrid pixel detector is an attempt to get the best of both worlds. So in the silicon microstrip detector, you get good position resolution, but it's complicated to make the detector. To add that second layer of perpendicular electrodes is actually pretty complicated. What you want is that spatial resolution advantage you get from a pixel detector, but you don't want the thing to take forever to read out. So what has been done is to go back to the microstrip detector and just chop up the microstrips. Okay? You just take the wires and you segment them, you isolate them so that they're in little pads. So, if, for instance, in Atlas, just as an example, the width in the hybrid pixel detector of Atlas, the width of these pads is about 50 microns, but the length is 400 microns. So they're not square. They're pretty long, actually. But they're segmented. So you get information on the position measurement in both directions. Okay? And each one of these little pieces of a microstrip, each one of these can be connected to a specific electronics readout channel electrically and read out. You don't have to do it sequentially, as we did in the pixel detector. And so you can read out all the channels at once, same time. So it's fast. So this has the advantages of position resolution, and since you can make these things as long as you want to get a little more charge, you don't have a lot of ionization to play with, so you make them a little longer. You can make them the length that you need, but you get some measurement of position in that direction, and you still get a fast readout. So the example I wanted to show you here is the Atlas Pixel Detector. So this is a diagram of what the thing would look like finished. So the silicon microscript tracker that I talked about is outside of this, but the pixel detector is inside of it. And here, again, you have this sort of barrels and disks idea. This is a cutaway, so pieces are missing. All right, and in fact, you can see what the thing looks like. This is in the lab before it was finished, but this just it's just a cylinder. They just have this framework, and it's just covered with channels, just a whole layer, one after. These are the electronic boards, but the actual silicon is you can see part of it sticking out, the orange stuff. Okay. So. Okay. All right. So that is semiconductor detectors. So the thing to note about those, really good position resolution. You can do them so they read out fairly quickly if you need to. And they're very useful for position measurements. They can be expensive, and you get a lot of channels. So that's one thing. So they have definite advantages over over gaseous technology. But the emphasis there is not so much on how fast, people saying, drift technology is really slow. Let's build something it's really on saying it can only get us to a certain position resolution. Let's make something that can do better. Here, we're going to talk about scintillating fibers. The emphasis is the other drawback, the other problem of gaseous detectors, which is let's take advantage of this 1 to 2 nanosecond time response of a scintillation pulse and try to build something that I can get my signal really fast. Okay, so if I have a lot of events coming in, I don't miss anything, I don't confuse things, Okay, now there are pros, there are advantages and disadvantages to each choice. You may not get the position resolution that you get in the semiconductor case. Okay, but let's see what we have. So in this case, the basic idea is you have a long plastic or glass or liquid tube of some kind, and in it you embed some scintillating additive. Okay, we talked about this before, so I won't go into it. But there are cases where it's a very, very thin glass tube with some liquid inside of it. Or it's a very, very thin plastic tube with liquid inside of it. Or it's sort of like your telephone lines. It's a long plastic tube that's very easy to bend and stuff like that. In that latter case, just as an example, what's happening is, so let's ignore this outer piece. This is a fiber. And a particle will pass through, and it will produce ionization, which will then scintillate. Okay? Very quickly. Now, a lot of these scintillation photons will go in all angles. They'll just come out in all angles. But a small fraction will go down the fiber, will go down the direction of the fiber, and they will go at a small enough angle that if the index of refraction outside of this thing is lower than this index of refraction, it will totally and totally reflect. Okay? So now, there's some efficiency here because it may reflect here, but it may pass out over here. So it may bounce many, many times going down the fiber. And there's one reason why these fibers are placed in something called a cladding, which is sort of an outer coating. Sometimes there's even two claddings. And that has, so in this case, we have air and the core index of refraction, and we have something that's in between. So something might not quite something might not quite be internally reflected here, but then on that next interface it will be. Okay? So it's a way of keeping more of the light in. So the size of the fibers are usually tens of microns to up to about a millimeter. That's the typical size. It's dictated a lot to do with the kind of position resolution you're trying to get. And if you take these and put them perpendicular to the path of a particle, sort of like the straw tube case. So if I have a situation like this, and I see a particular fiber with light in it and all the neighbors don't, then I know something about where that particle passed through. And if I do that several times, now I know the particle's trajectory, okay? What's nice about this is that it's fast, and you can get spatial resolution about as good as a gaseous detector. there's really no loss of ability here. Let's see if I can example here. So an example would be something like this. That's in Gruppen and Schwarz. It's not the best picture in the world, but it gives you the idea. So obviously there was a particle that passed vertically, and it seems like they missed a lot of hits. There must be something wrong with their detector, but they saw something. Okay, congratulations. The scintillation light, actually, I don't know. I need to say this. Yeah, I've already said that. We don't need to go into that. Now, this is a terrible drawing. There's two things we could talk about. Well, first of all, how do you measure the spatial coordinate? Well, one thing is if I have a fiber, if it passes right through the middle of the fiber, I'm going to get more scintillation light than if I just clip the edge of it. Okay? So the amount of light that you see actually can tell you where in the fiber you were. It's kind of analogous to measuring the drift time. Okay? The drift time, you know, say you're in a drift tube, the drift time tells you where in the tube you were. Here, the amount of light tells you where in the fiber you were relative to the diameter. Okay? So you can measure the position resolution in this direction better if you know the pulse height, meaning if you know the signal size from the scintillation in that fiber. But that doesn't get us the second coordinate. So how do we do the second coordinate? Doing the second coordinate, I won't even try to draw it again. Doing the second coordinate is the same thing that we did before with multi-wire chambers, with the silicon microstrip trackers, which is that you take two planes of fibers and you put the fiber orientation at some angle with respect to each other. And if you do that, you can use it to identify the position. So I'll do one attempt at this. Let's say I have two fibers going in this direction and two fibers going in this direction. If I have a particle come in here, okay, well, it's going to show up on this fiber here, and it's going to show up on this fiber. So I know where those two fibers cross. It's right here. I know the two dimensions. Now, if this angle is really small, then I'm going to get a situation like this. And this diamond is going to be really long. So I'm going to lose sensitivity to that coordinate because of that. Obviously, if they're at right angles, I get sensitivity. Okay. However, in a collider detector, it would be very hard to build this so that they're like this. It's got to be a cylindrical detector. There's no way to do that. So you end up with this sort of a situation. So you don't get as good of a measurement in this direction as you get in this direction, but you still get a decent measurement. So then you have to decide, what does that angle theta need to be? How well do I need to do, to do whatever physics I'm trying to do? Now, in the other cases, we were dealing with detectors where the readout was straightforward, an electronic pulse was produced, and we read it out. It's just a current. In this case, one is using a device, photomultiplier tubes, and I am going to have a guest lecturer. I think Steve will talk to you guys, so I may reserve that topic for him to talk to you guys about, so we'll see. But I don't want to go into that right now. Or there are semiconductor detectors that are light sensitive for the reasons I already told you. Semiconductors have energy gaps approximately the size of an optical photon energy. And so scintillation light is approximately the wavelengths of optical light. And so the semiconductors are a nice way to read them out. Okay? So an example of this kind of tracker is the D0 CFT, central fiber tracker. So now, this is just an example of a kind of issue. In this particular device, you have this problem that light's going to go down these fibers, but only the light at the very, very smallest angles is going to get to the end of that fiber. These fibers are almost as long as this room. Okay? So that's a tiny fraction of all the scintillation light that you made, the tiny fraction that got to the end of that fiber. So every single photon that gets to the end of that fiber, you want to find. Okay? You want to count it. So in a semiconductor detector, a photo detector, and this would be not possible in the case of a electronic detector like a photomultiplier tube, you can actually see each photon. So each of these peaks is the first photoelectron produced from one photon, the second photoelectron produced from a second photon, etc. So you can literally count, you know how many photons there were, And if I know how many photons there were, I erased it. As I said, you can say where in the fiber you are. Okay? So that becomes useful information. And then this is just showing you what it would look like. You have to have these two layers for the reasons that I mentioned about the straw tubes, that there's a gap that particles can go through. So you see in this layer, this particle would not have produced light in the first layer. You had to have the second layer to produce it. Okay? So you have to always have these doublets, they're called. But you get many measurements, and from that you can determine a track.